Morning, everyone. Hopefully more people will start trickling in. First, before I announce our speaker, just wanted to remind everybody about the Internal Medicine Conference coming up the last weekend of March. It's Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, and Sunday morning. It's being held over at the Marriott over Military Trail. It's the Marriott Town Center, I guess, technically. And so if you all could register, we'd appreciate it. This morning, I'm going to introduce Dr. Greg Golden, who joined the Lynn Cancer Institute Radiation Oncology team. He's originally from Boca Raton and did his medical degree at the University of Miami School of Medicine. He participated in the regional program at FAU, where he spent his first 2 years of medical school. Dr. Golden completed a preliminary intern year in general surgery at the University of Florida Shands in Jacksonville, and then he did a residency in radiation oncology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and practiced for his first 2 years in Nashville before coming home to Boca. Today he's going to give us a talk on complications of radiation therapy.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin. Yeah, so it's an honor to be here. I've been back in Boca now for about 2 years, born and raised here. Actually not born in Boca Hospital. My mom was a hippie, so she had me at home with a midwife, but it's an honor to be here and care for my community and look forward to speaking about an important topic today that's increasingly relevant for all of us. So I have no financial disclosures. And this talk was actually really easy to put together because there's no complications from radiation. So we can all go back to work and we can go home now. I'm just kidding. We don't live in a world of rainbows and butterflies, unfortunately. Our patients have complex issues. Cancer treatments are aggressive. In general, to accomplish the goals of therapy, whether it be palliation or cure, we do accept at least a small rate of toxicity. And that depends, of course, on the cancer, the stage of the cancer, the goals of the therapy, the patient, you know, the age of the patient, comorbidities, depends on how much we may push the envelope with the treatments. We know that cancer is complex. Our patients are complex. They have comorbid issues. Psychosocial issues, there's a financial burden, there's a great need for a multidisciplinary approach. And, you know, I put this at the bottom here because it's kind of the general sense that we get in the radiation department is that it's ill understood exactly what we're doing with your patients and, you know, exactly what our therapy involves and what types of side effects to expect for different radiation treatments. So I hope to go through some representative radiation plans to illustrate what some expected side effects may be. And of course, related to that point, many of these patients will have issues not related to the radiation side effects. So it's important to be able to differentiate and for the general practitioner, other specialists to recognize, you know, this is not a radiation side effect. I need to have my antennae up, be thinking about something else that could be going on. And of course, we're going to be caring for more cancer survivors in the future. I think that these curves are pretty impressive, how they're just starting to skyrocket there. We're going to be taking care of more elderly patients as well. The baby boomers are coming of age, as we know. In general, cancer survival rates have been increasing over the past 40 years. So I think that speaks to the fact that cancer therapies and early detection rates are improving. This is an interesting slide because it lists cancer out in terms of prognosis as well. So you can see some of the better performing cancers towards the top and some of the more evil actors at the bottom there. So the objectives of this talk, we're going to discuss some of the physical, chemical, and biological principles of radiation oncology, learn some of the various mechanisms of radiation delivery, and review radiation plans to understand some of the expected complications, which of course depends on the total radiation dose, you know, how intense you deliver a treatment. You may deliver a less intense treatment for a palliative regimen, so you wouldn't expect nearly the same degree of short and late side effects, perhaps. Also, the treatment volume, how large is the treatment field, and what adjacent tissues are exposed to that radiation field. And then, of course, again, the patient themselves. We know that there's individual sensitivity to radiation. Some people are just more sensitive. There's obviously a genetic basis to this that we're just starting to unravel now. It doesn't yet guide treatment, though. and of course the age of the patient, if they've been smokers, diabetics, what have you. So just to start with a case, something that's very common to see in the inpatient setting, 62-year-old male presents with back pain and progressive lower extremity weakness and numbness. No prior history of cancer. The pain began 6 months ago, the weakness about 3 months ago. He's been using a walker for 3 days. He's had some weight loss, also some associated urinary and bowel retention. So his physical exam, his KPS is 70. He's got weak motor strength bilaterally. He's got worse sensation in his feet compared to his hands, and he has hyperreflexia. And some laboratory data is obtained first, and it reveals a PSA is markedly abnormal. An MRI is ultimately obtained to characterize the back pain, and he's found to have three areas of dural sac compression. And you can see here, this shows the cancerous vertebrae and the normal vertebrae, and you know, what we're interested in seeing here is the tumor is pushing on this thecal sac, which is in white, and the spinal cord, which is in gray. Especially at this area here, it looks like it's really getting compressed. And here. So the management options for this patient, of course, steroids would be indicated first to reduce edema. Surgery for a fit patient, for a patient where there's bone instability, radiation is not going to pull bone off of the cord. So that's a very common indication for surgery is to stabilize the bones, and you might end up with something similar to this with the hardware that's being placed, and they also need to decompress the spinal cord, make sure there's no tumor abutting the spinal cord. And then radiation would be indicated after surgery because the surgeon is not removing all the cancer in the bone, so it's standard to do radiation once the incision is healed 2 weeks after surgery. If for whatever reason the patient doesn't have surgery, then radiation would be indicated in lieu of surgery. You would be concerned that the control rate may be less, that the cancer would have a higher chance of recurring at that area if the patient doesn't have surgery. And then, of course, once the staging workup's complete and the spine is stabilized, they would need to start androgen deprivation therapy for this presumptive diagnosis of prostate cancer. But I'm really interested in honing in on, you know, what is radiation involved for this type of patient? So we'll review that later in the talk. But it's important to remember that radiation has been a tool in treating cancer for over a century now. 60% of patients, more than half of patients, receive radiation as part of their treatment. Radiation oncologists treat with the intent of cure or palliation, so to improve pain, bleeding, open airways, or hollow visci, we can help with that if there's tumor compressing different areas in the body. So again, radiation dates back to the 1800s. We've had the linear accelerator here, which is the workhorse of the radiation department since the early 1950s. There's been lots of advances over the past five decades, which have paralleled advances in computer science. So just to dig a bit deeper into the physical aspect of radiation, there's two types. There's non-ionizing and ionizing radiation. And just to remind us, this is the electromagnetic spectrum. So you see shorter wavelength towards the left. So starting on the right, we have, you know, radar, microwaves, radio waves, infrared, and then UV light, what we're seeing right now. And then beyond that, X-rays and gamma rays. And so energy is inversely proportional to wavelength. So as you go to a shorter wavelength, these particle wave packets have higher degrees of energy. So this is where we're working in the radiation oncology department, in the gamma and X-ray. So again, non-ionizing radiation can be detected as heat. So there's excitation of the outer electron, and this is detected as an infrared map with a heat signature. Ionizing radiation actually expels the outer electron and creates ions, which then form free radicals in the cell. And as we recall from organic chemistry, free radicals just kind of wreak havoc in the cell, and there's a domino effect of molecular destruction. And then the important biological targets within the cell, of course, is the DNA, which is located in the cell nucleus, and the damage ultimately leads to apoptosis, which can lead to tumor destruction and tissue injury. And so this is just demonstrating the two prominent ways that radiation works. More often, it works indirectly through typically a water molecule that then injures the DNA. Less often and more commonly with particle therapy like protons or radiation, there's a direct action where the particle directly damages the DNA. And so again, this is showing the most common mechanism of DNA injury and why oxygen matters so much for us in radiation oncology. We really like to keep the hemoglobin above 10, at a minimum above 8, because oxygen helps to bind the radicals and stabilize the DNA injury. So it forms superoxides and peroxides, which then stabilize the injury and prevent the cancer cell from being able to repair the injury. And so this shows some of the more common types of DNA injury, with these being probably the most common, the single strand breaks and the base changes. These are the most effective. These are the most difficult for the cancer cell to repair, the double strand breaks. So again, radiation works by damaging DNA. In general, both normal and cancer cells are affected by radiation. We can conform the volume. We can do our best to minimize exposure to normal tissues, but it's unavoidable that normal tissues are going to be affected. But there is a difference in the cancer cell's ability to repair DNA injury. Our normal cells can repair DNA injury better than cancer cells can, and that's one reason why cancer cells became cancerous in the first place. They lack the ability to repair these ongoing mutations in their DNA. So we kind of take advantage of that. And of course, all tissues have a different tolerance level, maximum dose, beyond which irreparable damage may occur. And that's true for different volumes of the tissue that you're speaking of. So in general, we're working within this therapeutic window where you have tumor control here on the left curve and normal tissue damage on the right curve. And as you can see, these are very steep curves. So, you know, your dose here on the x-axis, if you're off just by a little bit, you could really, you could have a lot of side effects, or, you know, you may not control the tumor. So you're really looking for this middle dotted line here. That's kind of the sweet spot. And we have data and guidelines based on decades of research in terms of, you know, what kinds of radiation regimens we should be using to get into this sweet spot. So in terms of side effects, there is latency, meaning that side effects don't start immediately once radiation starts. There's both short-term side effects, which generally begin about 10 to 14 days after radiation initiates, and then there's late side effects, which generally don't occur during the time of radiation, but they can occur 6 weeks or later after radiation ends. And those can be transient or permanent delayed effects. The short-term side effects generally are transient. They do improve. So the acute effects, we can see effects on the gut. These are all rapidly dividing epithelia or bone marrow. So the gut, the skin, the bone marrow, and the mucosa. And then the late effects, this is not all inclusive, but the brain, the spinal cord, the kidney, the lung, and the bladder are various examples. So short-term side effects, again, results from destruction or injury to compartments of rapidly dividing epithelial tissue. The result is inflammation and sloughing of the tissue. There are stem cells that are affected, which impairs the ability of the tissue to replenish itself. Not all of the stem cells are eradicated, which is why the short-term effects, why the patient ultimately heals completely or near completely after the radiation regimen is over. And again, just to list some of the more common short-term side effects here. Also, it should be noted that local inflammation can result in edema, redness, warmth, and sometimes you can see a pain flare after starting radiation. You can see swelling locally at the tumor site. So sometimes we can use steroids to work on that pain flare. So the long-term effects include fibrosis and organ damage, and there's a well-characterized cascade of cytokines, and it just proliferates for weeks, months, and even years, where there's subendothelial damage, which eventually leads to radiation-induced arteriosclerosis. And it depends on the organ you're talking about in terms of what the latency time may be to see that. But this can happen anywhere in the body. Nearly all patients will experience some level of fatigue due to the pro-inflammatory cytokine cascade. And that level of fatigue likely depends on the individual sensitivity, the patient's activity level. We know that if you're more active, it helps to combat the fatigue. So we typically instruct our patients to stay active during radiation and maintain a good nutritional status. And it's important to realize that there's different normal tissues, how we think about them. So the spinal cord is not the same as the lung. You can actually irradiate, and we know you can take out a lobe of someone's lung, and they can go on to function just fine. The spinal cord, you can't do that. So that's kind of how we think about different tissues throughout the body. There's certain tissues that have a little bit more forgiveness because they are in parallel, and there's a functional reserve that the organ has. So again, the goals are to cure cancer or palliate symptoms. In general, radiation occurs over 1 week to as many as 9 weeks. I actually don't really treat anyone in 10 weeks. 45 treatments, 5 days a week is the most that I currently do. The acute effects are cumulative, and again, they start 10 to 14 days after radiation starts. And then it takes a few weeks after you finish, and then you turn the corner. And then they'll gradually heal, generally in the same time frame that they took to come on. So these are the acute effects. And this is an example of dermatitis, where you're seeing redness of the skin and just a little bit of moist desquamation, where the skin has perhaps broken open a bit here, indicated by the shiny area. So side effects, again, depend on the site. We're going to go through all of these, so we don't need to review them in detail right now. Modern radiation therapy techniques have decreased these side effects. We're much more precise with our radiation delivery. We're able to line patients up on the machine more confidently with the images that we can take and different structures that we align on. There's tattoo marks on the skin that we use. There's lasers on the wall to align to the tattoo marks. And then we'll also take x-rays or CAT scans before the treatment begins to make sure that the patient is truly in the right position underneath the radiation beam. And so the treatment process for us starts with the consultation and eventually the simulation. And the simulation is basically a dedicated CAT scan where the patient is placed in the same position that they'll be in for the treatment. So it's very important that the patient's in a comfortable position, that they're immobilized. So in this situation, it's either a brain or a head and neck treatment. The patient's wearing an Aquaplast mask, which is a customized plastic mask that conforms to their face. And it's fairly tight. It shouldn't be painful, but it's tight enough so that they can't really wiggle around too much. And most patients, if they can tolerate an MRI, they do okay with this. You can see through the mask. You can breathe through it. So then you get a CT scan. We may make a mold that they lie in, like a beanbag device, to help get their body in the same position each day. And then we have pictures on the computer, and we use those as a reference. We can fuse the PET scan and the MRI for additional information to guide the drawing the target volume. So on the computer, we're going to draw the target area, including the tumor, any adjacent lymph node regions that we want to target. And then we also draw all of the surrounding normal critical structures. So when it comes to radiation planning, we use sophisticated software to determine the angles that the radiation beam should come in on. We have medical physicists who checks the chart and dose calculations and does quality and assurance on our machines. And so this is an example of a prostate radiation plan, where you see there are five radiation beams coming from different angles. You can see that the beams are shaped. You can see the shape here, and then the intensity corresponds to the thickness of the beam. So this is just to give you an idea of kind of what's involved. We're trying to avoid the hip bones here, the rectum, and then the bladder will be superior. This is an example of a radiation plan, a right-sided breast patient, where we use two beams, and they're called tangential beams, so it's actually coming from in front of the patient and skims along underneath the chest wall. So you can see what normal tissues are exposed here. We have a little bit of lung, a little bit of rib, muscle, breast, skin. The heart is out of field on the right-sided breast plans, but can be more of an issue on left-sided breast plans that we'll take a look at in a bit. This is a left optic nerve sheath meningioma, and all of these lines correspond to radiation dose. So, you know, the 100% lines are going to be in here, and then as you come out, this dark blue is coming out to 40%, and it shows how we label the brain area, the temporal lobes, the globes, the lens, the optic nerves. You won't try to spare the left optic nerve in this patient, but it's critical to protect the right optic nerve to maximize a chance for preserving vision in that side. The left optic nerve, you're going to take this tumor likely to the tolerance level of that nerve, where you might produce a 5% chance of complications is what we would kind of expect. So the dose volume histogram is an important tool for us, where we plot the dose to each structure, to the volume that structure receives. And this is how we can gauge whether our plan is safe and effective. So the target is out here. The PTV is the target volume. And we like to see that has good coverage at prescription dose, 100% at prescription dose, 70 gray, 7,000 centigray. And then we like to see all of our normal tissues. We look at different dose levels to make sure that they're meeting different metrics that we have, which are available institutionally and also nationally. There's published guidelines. It also allows for comparison between plans. So these are actually two different plans, one in the dotted line, one in the solid line. And so this dotted line plan has better coverage of the target, but there's also increased exposure to the normal tissue. So seeing this, you might choose the solid line. You may not want to sacrifice increased risk for a marginal benefit. Each radiation treatment plan goes through a lot of safety checks. Again, there's a lot of QA involved. The machines are calibrated on a periodic basis. The physicists check the output. The therapists do that every day. So it's very quality controlled. There have been errors in radiation medicine, so we do our best to prevent that in our clinic. Delivery of radiation, again, typically occurs with a linear accelerator. Basically what this is doing is it's taking electricity from the wall and it's taking electrons and speeding them up close to the speed of light, and you're bombarding those electrons against a heavy metal. It's typically tungsten in the head of the machine, and then that produces Bremsstrahlung radiation, which is a form of X-ray radiation that could then be shaped and modulated by the machine. You can also use internal radiation therapy or brachytherapy, which is actually radioactive seeds. Those are live sources, and we do use those in our clinic. The modern unit of radiation is the gray, so that's similar to your milligram or gram in drugs. So 1 gray equals 100 centigray. Which brings us to examples of radiation treatment plans. So to start off with prostate, we know that there's a lot of advertisements. We have the CyberKnife, the newest M6 machine. These are examples of radiation plans. So typically we only offer CyberKnife radiation to men with low risk or favorable intermediate risk prostate cancer as defined by their Gleason score, PSA, and clinical T stage. We have been using it as a boost or extra dose of radiation to the prostate at the end of high-risk cases where we're covering perhaps lymph nodes, and then we do extra radiation at the end. But this is an example of what a radiation plan may look like. So what you see here is the prostate gland in the three different views of the CT simulation scan, and you have the bladder sitting above the prostate. You have the seminal vesicles here, which are like bunny ears that stick above the prostate. You have the rectum behind the prostate. Penile bulb is contoured down here. And so the goal is to maximize the radiation that treats the prostate while minimizing the surrounding exposure to the normal tissues.
Also, we label the urethra, which runs directly through the middle of the prostate, and we do our best to make sure that there are no hot spots within the urethra to minimize side effects. So what types of side effects may we see from this type of treatment? Well, it's the normal tissues in the field, so urethra, the bottom of the bladder, and the rectum. So the acute effects commonly include urethritis, cystitis, and proctitis. And of course, we can see fatigue because we're producing that inflammatory cytokine cascade. But those are really mainly it in terms of the short-term side effects. The effect on the sexual nerves doesn't occur until much later, typically many, many months, if not a year or two. There could be some low-grade changes in bowels and urination after CyberKnife radiation, which are late effects. We have to protect the hip bones. In theory, there's a 1-2% chance that if a man has a fall, these bones could be a bit more brittle and they could be more subject to having a pelvic fracture, including in the coccyx area. One thing that we're doing to help minimize the side effects these days, and I've done about 30 of these, is at the same time that we place markers in the prostate gland for image guidance, we're placing what's called a SpaceOAR hydrogel, which has been FDA approved since 2015, and there's randomized evidence to support this, that there's improvement in quality of life. And what we can accomplish is we place this transperineally under ultrasound guidance. So there's an ultrasound in the rectum, and I place my markers into the prostate, and then what I do is I develop a space in de Novière's fascia between the prostate and the rectum. I inject saline to separate the prostate and the rectum, and then we inject about 10 cc's of this hydrogel, which is a temporary apparatus. So it's actually absorbed by the body 90 days after it's placed. What it accomplishes for us is it keeps the rectum off of the high-dose radiation field. So it's really a game changer for us, and it's helped to plummet the rectal toxicity. So we're not seeing as much in the way of the rectal bleeding that we used to, and also the loose stools during radiation are less of an issue these days. So it's a really nice tool to have. And we're exploring it in other treatment sites as well. The manufacturer is interested in exploring this in pancreatic cancer, so we may be undertaking that soon as well. There's also the prostate seed implant. So this is an example of what it looks like. And so this is also done under ultrasound guidance. And what you do is you fix a template in place, which is attached to the ultrasound equipment. And you have a template of where these needles need to be placed. So it's almost like playing Battleship, where you have different holes that you're sticking the needles through on this template. And the goal is to cover the prostate circumferentially and thoroughly. There's two different types of implants, brachytherapy seed implants. There's a low dose rate implant, which is also known as the permanent seed implant. So this is actually, you're just leaving seeds permanently. You're letting them drop there, and then they decay over 6 months, so they're like dying batteries. Most of the energy is deposited in the first 2 months, so that's when you see most of the side effects. Versus the other type of brachytherapy, which is called high dose rate. And what you're doing in high dose rate is you're actually inserting about 20 to 25 hollow needles, and they all will stay in the prostate at the same time. And then you attach a single radioactive seed. So that all the cables, all of the catheters are attached to cables, and there's a radiation seed that can move into all of the catheters step by step, and it will sit at each step maybe a few seconds, and there may be 150 steps or 200 steps total, and it'll deliver the radiation, and then the seed comes out of the patient and it goes back into the shielding. The patient is not radioactive in that situation, so the radiation's been delivered, and it's typically it requires 2 to 4 treatments. So it does, it's a bit more intensive. You have to repeat the procedure with that one, but it does offer more customization. You can better kind of tailor the radiation dose. There's more flexibility with doing a high dose rate plan because you can control where that seed stops versus this, where you're just kind of dropping the seeds and hoping for the best. So again, this is the radiation zone. It shows what normal tissues are affected. This is an example of what we might do for a man with high risk prostate cancer, where you feel obligated to cover the pelvic lymph nodes. So Generally, if there is more than a 15% risk of microscopic pelvic nodal involvement, which you can estimate off of published nomograms, you might cover the lymph nodes electively to a lower dose. So this is an example of, you know, what you might do. You would prescribe the prostate to a high dose. You know the disease is there. Perhaps the seminal vesicles involved, so that needs to get a higher dose as well. And then you cover the lymph nodes electively to lower doses while protecting the sigmoid colon and the bladder, which live centrally here. And so just to reiterate some of the symptoms that we might see: loose frequent stools, burning with urination, burning with defecation, urgency, really incontinence would be atypical. It's only if someone has underlying issues. Bleeding is much less of a problem, ulceration as well with the spacer that we're using. The bladder urethra, we can see dysuria, frequency, increase in nocturia, hesitancy, and then there's a 10 to 20% chance of some low-grade permanent changes to bowel and bladder function. We can see enteritis. Pelvic bone fractures are usually a late complication. Erectile dysfunction is a late complication. Typically, radiation to the prostate and seminal vesicles does cause dry ejaculate. So a man can have an orgasm, but there's a, you know, same fun, no mess is what my attending used to say. Some of the complications we might see, this is an example of hemorrhagic cystitis, where they may have to use some cauterization or laser therapy to stop the bleeding. The rate of this is less than 1 to 2% that someone has clinically significant hemorrhagic proctitis or cystitis. But I think, you know, that those cases stick out in a lot of our minds because we just tend to remember them. We talked about the sexual dysfunction. It's often does respond to Viagra or Cialis because the way radiation is affecting the nerves is it's scarring down the sexual nerves, the arteries that feed the sexual nerves. So it's causing arteriosclerosis on those arteries, and the drugs will work by dilating the arteries and improving blood flow to the sexual nerves. And then again, we can also see pelvic fractures. This is an example of a coccygeal fracture. More of an issue, I think, up north where people are slipping on ice. Some examples of some therapies that we might recommend during radiation treatment: over-the-counter medicines are typically what we start with. So Peridium, Imodium, Advil. Advil can be very effective if our patients can take it because we're causing inflammation. So an anti-inflammatory can actually work to ease the swelling on the prostate, which is leading to a lot of those symptoms. If the over-the-counter medicines are not enough, we may turn to Flomax or Ditropan. Transitioning to skin cancer, this is an example of a brachytherapy procedure that we are very specialized in, and we're lucky to have these tools. So this patient has a lesion on the right nasal sidewall, and this is showing you the applicator, what it looks like. The radiation is very superficial, so it's a very targeted treatment, which is very nice for small lesions. So we might do something like this in 6 to 8 treatments that are done every other day, and they're just 5 to 10 minute sessions. And this is a great alternative to, you know, the surgical treatment, which would be Mohs, which could require plastic surgical reconstruction. So I think this is an underutilized treatment for a lot of our patients in the community who are, I think, over-subjected to Mohs surgery. Especially people who are on blood thinners, we don't have to take them off blood thinners for this. So it's, you know, it's really important to remember that we can treat skin cancer, and it's just as effective as surgery. A lot of people would argue that the cosmesis is better with radiation. Another example of how we might treat a total scalp for a very aggressive melanoma or angiosarcoma of the scalp, where you're covering the lymph nodes here as well in the neck. This is an IMRT plan, intensity modulated radiation. So the photons are conforming to the scalp and trying to minimize the exposure to the underlying brain. So the main side effect in skin treatment, of course, is dermatitis. And this is showing us the different stages of dermatitis from left to right. With right, we're seeing moist desquamation, which is kind of the end result you know, which we would expect to see in a skin treatment, but we do need to treat and make sure we prevent infection. So we would typically provide creams to prevent infection, like Silvadine is what we like to use. We know that we need to be on guard for different situations where the patient may not heal as well. So areas that are edematous, we may get the wound care clinic involved to work on the edema. Patients who are smokers or diabetics, we need to work to prevent infection. Of course, if there's persistent tumor, so if you have a wound that you've treated and 6 weeks go by, you've done radiation, still not healing, we have to be suspicious that, you know, the radiation may not have worked and there's tumor that's preventing the healing. And that happens from time to time. These are some of the remedies that we use for dermatitis. I tend to like Aquaphor, and I'm okay with pure aloe. And then, of course, Silvadine to prevent infections, hydrocortisone for itching. Coming to breast cancer, this is an example of left-sided breast cancer, and one of the measures that we commonly do to minimize exposure to the heart, we do what's called a deep inspiration breath hold. So we actually only treat the patient, if this proves to be beneficial for this for the said patient, we have the patient hold their breath, and only while they're holding the breath is the radiation treatment machine on. So it shows you here what it may look like with free breathing. And then with that breath hold, the heart can move lower in the chest cavity and more posterior, effectively away from the radiation field. This is an example of what we may do for breast cancer that needs elective nodal coverage. So the elective nodes live all along these areas. So we would typically target the axilla, the supraclavicular fossa, the low cervical neck, and depending on the tumor location, we may cover the internal mammary nodes. And so obviously that increases the amount of skin that's in the radiation field. It also increases the amount of lung and rib bone in the radiation field. If you're trying to cover the internal mammary nodes, it may increase the amount of heart in the radiation field as well, depending on patient anatomy. This is some examples of partial breast radiation. So for women with very early stage breast cancer, this may be a good option. There's various other criteria that need to be met to be eligible for this. But generally, this is for early stage breast cancer, where it's been shown that it appears to be safe and effective to just treat the cavity where the tumor was removed. And one method that we have is we can place a balloon catheter into the cavity, which has all these different channels, and then we could take that radiation seed and send them up into the channels, and then they stop at certain points, and you can get a nice conformal radiation plan to minimize dose to the skin, maximize coverage of the cavity, and then you'd also be interested in seeing what's going on underneath with the rib bones and the heart. Another specialized device that we have to give partial breast radiation is the AccuBoost machine, and this is very similar to having a mammogram done, except we're delivering therapeutic doses of radiation. So what we do is we compress the breast, either craniocaudal or medial lateral, and we deliver the treatment. We first get an image before we deliver the treatment, and we find the tumor bed, usually illustrated by the clips that the surgeon has left, and we have different cones that we can use to conform to the clips, and so the radiation is actually being delivered, you know, from within this cone. And it's really nice because you're completely parallel to the chest cavity, so there's really nothing going, you know, deep. There's not much exposure going deep. So for women who are a good candidate for this, it's a really nice option to have. So, to further illustrate some of the side effects we might see, some of the early effects, we can see skin thickening, breast edema. More later, we can see fat necrosis, which can sometimes cause fibrosis, and it can be slightly painful for women. We could see radiation-induced pneumonitis, not pneumonia, it's pneumonitis, and that's inflammation of the lung. Typically 3 to 6 months after radiation ends, there's about a 3% risk of pneumonitis. We can use a steroid to improve that if it's needed. Typically, the pneumonitis is not severe. It doesn't require hospitalization. A patient may have dry cough or some increased shortness of breath with exertion. And that has to do with the lung that's being exposed just underneath the rib area. More common things that we see, skin retraction. If a woman is still breastfeeding, we can see obviously difficulty with the normal function of the breast, with lactation difficulty. The rib bones, in general, there can be about a 3% risk, 2 to 3% risk of having more brittle bones underneath the radiation field, the bones that were exposed there. So we say, you know, God forbid if you're hit in the chest or in a car accident, you could fracture the bones a bit more easily on that side. You could see scarring of the lung, but usually that's not clinically significant. Usually just see it on the scan. It would be very rare to have a patient that needs to go on oxygen after having radiation therapy for breast cancer. In generally, this is a very safe treatment. Perhaps the more concerning side effects, what we see on the bottom, for left-sided cancer, we worry about cardiomyopathy. And, of course, for young women who may live 15, 20 years or more, we worry about radiation-induced malignancy, which is not trivial. It's on the order of perhaps 1 to 2%. And typically only occurs in the radiation field. So typically you're worried about a skin cancer in the radiation field in terms of the radiation-induced malignancy for breast cancer. And this just further illustrates the risk of ischemic heart disease. There was a seminal paper published in 2013 in New England Journal, which showed that the relative risk increases by 7.4% for each 1 gray of radiation to the heart. Okay, so, you know, let's break that down and put that into real-life terms. So many women for left-sided breast cancer with modern radiation treatment will receive generally between 1 to 3 gray. So the relative risk may increase by 20%. Say they, 7.4 by times 3. So the relative risk is increasing by 20%. So the average woman has about a 7% absolute risk of coronary event before age 80. So 20% of 7% is about, 1 or 2%. So in reality, we may raise a woman's risk of a cardiac event by 1 or 2%. Still low, but, it's almost like having another coronary risk factor. So we always advise women that, there's some exposure to the heart. It's important that you lead a heart-healthy lifestyle. Quit smoking. You need to eat a good diet, exercise, get you plugged in with a cardiologist once you're, through all this. And just to reiterate some of the biggest risk factors for radiation-induced heart disease, for large exposures to the heart, so this is not what you see in breast cancer, but, what you might see in lymphoma or esophageal cancer, for example, there's higher doses that are delivered to the heart. So you're much more concerned about those patients that they have some significant risk. Obviously, patients who are younger, these effects take 5, 10, 15 years to manifest. So the longer a patient lives, radiation is the gift that keeps on giving. So these effects are going to keep occurring. Also, higher dose per fraction. So if you're using a larger dose each day, we know that that correlates with the rate of late effects. If your target volume is close to the heart, obviously. If you're not shielding the heart, if you're using chemotherapy medications like doxorubicin, that will also increase risk to the heart. Also, Herceptin has a mild risk to the heart. And then, of course, underlying cardiovascular risk factors need to be considered as well. Transitioning to lung cancer, so here's an example of a radiation field for lung cancer. So obviously, it depends on where in the lung you're talking. You can see the skin is exposed. There's rib bones. There's soft tissue. There's part of the heart, looks like the right atrium, perhaps. You have the spinal cord. Usually, the large vessels are not a concern in radiation. These large vessels can handle a lot of radiation. And so the clinical effects you may be concerned about with this CyberKnife plan, which different from this plan where you're kind of using a larger volume, the CyberKnife plan, we're treating smaller lesions with CyberKnife, so it's much more conformal and smaller. But even with this plan, you're concerned about the rib bone, so there may be, you may accept a 15 to 20% chance of rib fracture, which could lead to pain. It'll heal, but it may take longer to heal if the patient's had radiation. But you may accept a 15% rate of rib fracture to control this tumor, because if If radiation doesn't control it, the tumor may cause, you know, pain and invade the bone. So you accept some toxicity. The surrounding lung may become scarred. Very unlikely to become clinically significant for this patient because the volume is so small, but for this patient, likely a different story. The heart for this patient looks like it's fairly well protected, but you'd be concerned about the low anterior descending coronary artery that may be running, you know, just adjacent to this area. Even low doses can cause some atherosclerosis there. So I'd be really pushing to keep this radiation plan tight at that interface. The esophagus is not a concern on this plan, but you know, with this plan, I forgot to mention the esophagus is wedged right here between the aorta and the heart. So you're likely going to see, as a main side effect for this treatment, esophagitis. So this radiation treatment, the roughest side effect that this patient likely would have is difficulty swallowing, maybe pain with swallowing. It may feel like they have a lump in their chest when they swallow. And again, that's typically a temporary side effect because it's a mucosal related tissue. The risk to the spinal cord would be minimal. We're really conservative and we do our best to protect the spinal cord. We do not accept paralysis as a side effect. This is illustrating some of the effects that we can see on the lung. So we can see radiation pneumonitis, which generally is transient, mild, and treatable, although patients may require admission to the hospital for this, and it's treated. Typically, we're not certain if it's an infection or if it's radiation, so typically they're started on antibiotics and steroids is what I've seen, and usually it is reversible. Though patients may require a steroid taper, and they may require oxygen therapy until their clinical status improves. This is an example of what's not reversible. So radiation fibrosis actually refers to scarring of the lung. And, you know, you hate to see this if it causes someone to be on oxygen or if it worsens their pulmonary status. The risk for this may be about 5%. Or less with those radiation plans that I showed you previously. To the esophagus, we may see a stricture after radiation is done. So that can be typically dilated with a balloon. You can go down with an endoscope and dilate that with a balloon. Transitioning to rectal cancer, here's a typical radiation field for rectal cancer. So the goal is to cover the mesorectum, the pelvic lymph nodes up to L5 or so. You also want to give good margin below the tumor. And so, obviously, the rectum is exposed, the bladder, pelvic bones, sexual nerves, and bowel, which is hanging down in the pelvis. So you could see proctitis, cystourethritis, late incidence of pelvic fractures, erectile dysfunction. And then in the short term, you're concerned about enteritis, but in the late long term, with surgery and radiation, you may be concerned about small bowel obstruction with the bowel seeing sometimes fairly significant doses of radiation. Anal cancer is generally the same as rectal, but the radiation field is brought much closer to the anus. So typically we're covering caudal to the anus, and we're covering the skin around the anus with just a slight margin. And so you're all over the sphincter muscles. And so one of the side effects you can see from anal cancer radiation treatments is you can see dysfunction of the anal sphincter. So patients typically may have difficulty differentiating gas from liquid from stool. Not everyone has this, and it typically improves slowly after radiation completes. We can work on it with Kegel exercises, and typically time is the best medicine. It's also very dependent on diet. We know that there's certain things that we eat that can cause more greasy, runny stools, so we tell patients to avoid those types of things if this is an issue. Also, fiber bulking stools can help a lot with this issue. And we can see sacral insufficiency fractures from these pelvic treatments, which can be difficult to treat. I know that some are trying kyphoplasties on these types of fractures, but they can be very difficult to manage and difficult to help patients with their pain. We can see lymphedema from targeting lymph nodes. So you can see this in the legs and the feet. when you're treating pelvic or abdominal malignancies. You can see edema in the arms when you're treating thoracic or breast axillary malignancies. We would refer our patients to lymphedema therapy for this, massage therapy. We can do wraps, and elevation of their limbs can be helpful. Transitioning to brain, here's a typical picture of a patient with metastatic disease to the brain. What we might do for this, a newer approach is to do whole brain radiation. Since there's so many lesions, I probably would not offer CyberKnife to this patient. Once there's more than 3 to 4 lesions, we tend to lean away from treating just the spots. We tend to recommend more comprehensive whole brain radiation because there's a higher chance they may have microscopic disease that may not be treated with the CyberKnife. And so a newer approach involving whole brain is to avoid the hippocampi. The main concern in the late term that many have with whole brain is that it has an effect on cognition and can affect the short-term memory. So it doesn't cause a dementia. It doesn't cause one to lose their personality or sense of humor, but it may cause someone to become more forgetful. So they may need to take more notes. They may have more trouble doing arithmetic in their head. And so one of the things that has been explored, and it looks like there is a signal in a positive direction where we can help patients by trying to spare their hippocampi as long as there's no lesions close by. We can also start them on Namenda, so memantine, which is used for Alzheimer's, can be effective to help preserve cognitive function. So here's a typical example of what a patient may experience in terms of side effects with a whole brain radiation treatment plan. So the main side effect is tiredness. Radiation to the brain tends to make people pretty darn tired. Also, the skin is affected, obviously, so we can see itching, irritation on the scalp. Typically, no peeling associated with this. Hair loss would be expected. The hair will grow back. 10% of the time, we can see worsening edema in the brain, and so that may correlate to worsening headaches, nausea, photophobia. Obviously, this can be serious if we cause, say, there's a tumor right next to the brain stem, and you treat with radiation, and then the lesion swells and pushes on the brain stem, and then it obstructs the ventricle. You know, that can be serious. The patient may need to go in for a shunt. So we need to be careful. Typically, you want to start steroids soon before you start radiation. You want to give the patients at least 24 hours on steroids before you start radiation to protect against some kind of life-threatening swelling that could be they could be at risk for. So again, that depends on where the tumor is located in a specific situation. We don't always start steroids prophylactically for all patients. Here's an example of CyberKnife stereotactic radiosurgery, which is a good option for this solitary left cerebellar metastasis. And this just shows you how there's hundreds of pencil thickness radiation beams which come in from different angles, but they all overlap and conform to this tumor, and then the radiation dose is very steep outside the tumor, so it falls off rapidly. So we protect the brainstem here. There's really not much skin getting radiation, so you probably wouldn't expect any hair loss. You know that these lines are not coming to the skin. You may be concerned about fatigue with this patient would probably be the only expected side effect, to be quite honest. A complication which may occur many months to years after radiation, the most significant complication that we worry about with CyberKnife is radiation necrosis. And that can be devastating sometimes. It can cause symptoms such as tumor progression, which can be stroke-like symptoms, depending on where the lesion is located. Generally, you want to use steroids first to work on this, because there's often edema associated with radiation necrosis. If steroids aren't enough, you may use Avastin. We can ask Dr. Chowdhury to help with some Avastin, or we may ask our surgical colleagues to actually perform an operation and just remove all of the necrosis. Often you'll find viable tumor in there as well. So, these can be kind of messy situations sometimes. Esophageal treatment, so a typical esophagus plan, Obviously, the esophagus is in field, so that's typically the worst short-term side effect that patients see. And this is an example of esophagitis underneath the endoscope. And so they may have odynophagia, dysphagia. You may have to use to a soft diet. Typically, they don't require feeding tubes. That would be unusual. Typically, feeding tubes are more required for head and neck treatments. And typically, we can get patients by as long as they're not super thin coming into us. Also, the heart can be exposed. This is a more significant heart exposure, this type of treatment. The lungs, which are an important consideration because often we're treating patients prior to surgery and they're going on to have an esophagectomy where their stomach will get pulled up into their thorax and they'll be on a ventilator after that operation. So we have to be careful with how much radiation we're exposing their lungs because, you know, they're going to be undergoing this major operation with postoperative ICU care. So to summarize, the side effects in the short term may be on the esophagus, the skin, tiredness. Those are the main short-term side effects. We can also see nausea if the tumor is low down and we're touching the stomach. And then again, the late effects primarily to the heart and the lungs. Pancreas. More often, we're treating this with CyberKnife. We typically need fiducial markers to target the pancreas because the CyberKnife machine cannot see the pancreas, the soft tissue. It's very difficult to image, so we have our endoscopists typically place between 3 to 4 markers inside the tumor. Sometimes we can use a stent and track off the stent, but this is an example of the radiation which is conforming to the tumor and the normal tissues. So the main tissues that you're worried about with this type of treatment is the bowel. So the duodenum here in purple, the small bowel and stomach up here, and typically, patients will get by 5 treatments. They may have some nausea. They may have some loose stools, which are transient and temporary short-term side effects. And then you worry that the main late complication could be ulceration of the duodenum or the bowel, or you could see small bowel obstruction. You could see bleeding. I've had patients with clinically significant bleeding where they've had to have coagulation and cauterization done to stop the bleeding. So this can be significant. These are high radiation doses we're using in this area. This is an example of a hemorrhagic duodenitis. Liver treatments, we treat hepatocellular carcinoma as a backup to surgical resection. We can use SBRT here, or we can use radioembolization, which is what Dr. Coriotti helps us with, where he snakes a catheter up through the groin and isolates the blood vessel that's feeding the tumor, and then we can basically inject these liquid radiation particles directly into the tumor. And so we just need to be careful to verify that pre-treatment the patient has adequate liver reserve, because I would expect, you know, all this liver here is going to become fibrotic. So it's almost akin to removing the liver. You will see regeneration, but you want to make sure that you're leaving the patient with enough healthy, normal liver that they're not going to go into hepatic failure. So that's the main concern with liver treatments that we deal with, is not inducing hepatic failure. And so the side effects for these types of treatments would include fatigue. You may see some swelling in the liver, so you can see stretching of the liver capsule, so they can have nausea associated with that, maybe vague upper abdominal pain. You may use steroids to work on those symptoms. And so here's an example of the radiation field here where you have healthy liver and you can see where the radiation line stopped. Bladder treatments. So obviously the bladder is encompassed within the radiation field, so you're going to see cystourethritis. You'll see proctitis here from the rectum, seeing radiation. You may see some skin. Okay, but it's fairly central, so the higher radiation lines are really not falling on the skin. So you would not expect high degree of dermatitis or peeling. You'd be worried about pelvic bone fracture in the late term. And then, again, the small bowel is a big concern here in this treatment. You may cause diarrhea, and then after the treatment, you'd be concerned about small bowel obstruction. Typically, patients will go on to have a fairly good lifestyle with respect to bladder function. So this, I think, is also an underutilized treatment for bladder cancer. Often So the gold standard, I should say, is cystectomy. We've been trying to conduct randomized trials to compare cystectomy to bladder-preserving chemoradiation. It's been very difficult to do those trials, but the data that's non-randomized appears to be very favorable, you know, in terms of radiation. And most of those patients are older and sicker. So I think this is also an underutilized treatment for many of our patients. Cervical cancer. So typically we're covering large fields of lymph node coverage here. So you treat the lymph nodes sometimes all the way up into the abdomen, up to the renal vessels. And so there's a lot of small bowel that would be you'd be concerned about. So small bowel obstruction in the late term could be diarrhea. In the short term, the rectum sees radiation, the bladder sees radiation. Typically, we're very good at stopping bleeding early on. So the second or third week, if a woman has cervical cancer, we can stop bleeding very effectively. This is an example of how we deliver a radiation boost in cervical cancer, and it's done via internal radiation. So these are actually called tandem and ovoid applicators. And there's two ovoids, which go into the vaginal fornices, and then there's one tandem, which goes up into the uterus with the goal to get it up to the top of the fundus. And there's a radiation seed that will travel into the catheters and sit at these areas for a specified period of time, and you'll get a radiation cloud, which will treat the uterus and the disease around the cervix. You may pull the cloud out, you know, to cover if there's disease coming to the pelvic sidewall, for example. You may leave the radiation seed here longer. But this can give more radiation dose to the bladder, the rectum, and the small bowel as well. But it is the best way of delivering more radiation to the tumor, to do it internally, because you don't need to pass from the outside of the body in. So in general, brachytherapy, if it's feasible, it is the best way, I think, to escalate radiation dose. And this is what you're concerned about in the late term for cervical cancer. For uterine cancer, Dr. Recio or Dr. Cirasano may do a TAH-BSO for us. And the most common situation is a woman with early stage cancer where there's a high rate of cure, but there may be a 15-20% chance that they could recur at the top of the vagina where the vagina is stitched closed. So he removes the cervix and the uterus, but the vagina is stitched closed at the top, and that's the highest place, the highest likelihood place that cancer may recur. So what we do is a local treatment with brachytherapy where we insert a cylinder, and there's a hollow channel in the middle of the cylinder, and we have the radiation seed move up here and deliver radiation from within the cylinder, and you can see how the radiation does touch the rectum and the bladder a bit. These are mainly short-term side effects. It's rare to have late effects on urination and bowel function. The most common side effect after this treatment is actually vaginal narrowing, where the vaginal walls at the top of the vagina can get narrowed, and that can preclude us from doing a good checkup to make sure that there's no cancer recurrence. So you would have a patient use a vaginal dilator maybe several times a week after they finish the treatment going forward to prevent that. And there's an example of the dilators that we might recommend. Head and neck cancer is quite a beast. It's often very difficult to manage because there's so many critical structures in such a tight compartment, and it's unavoidable that the esophagus is exposed, the swallowing function is affected, the salivary glands cause dry mouth. Often patients may need a feeding tube to get them through. Nutrition, hydration are really, you know, key things to keep an eye on, because side effects can be worse if they're malnourished. Often they're getting concurrent chemotherapy, which further enhances the toxic effects of radiation. So we may see oral stomatitis, fatigue, brisk dermatitis and peeling, pain with swallowing, dry mouth, thick sputum. I mean, I can go on and on. It's really, you know, it's a difficult treatment for our patients. Here's an example of what the mucositis may look like and the different degrees of mucositis. Dry mouth. One of the late complications that we worry about is osteoradionecrosis. So this is this man's mandible, which You don't want to be seeing mandible, and this can be very serious. So bone that's seen radiation is less well vascularized. So this bone is at risk for infection, and the body won't be able to fight off the infection. And that can just, you know, it can become a disaster sometimes where bone needs to be resected. They may need to resect mandible. So this is one of the more severe complications, which is less than 1% to 2% risk. We treat sarcomas. Often we enable organ preservation with sarcoma. So in specific extremity sarcoma, we can, the surgical option may otherwise be amputation, but by using preoperative radiation, we may help to preserve the limb. Here's an example of retroperitoneal, a massive retroperitoneal sarcoma, and the radiation dose lines that you may see. Obviously, bowel would be a concern here, liver, kidney, almost every organ in the abdomen would be at risk here. And then, you know, here you're conforming the radiation to minimize the chance of late fracture. We know that the periosteum has blood vessels which nourish and oxygenate the bone, and radiation can sclerose those small blood vessels, which can then cause the brittle bone that we can see. So by carving the radiation around the bone, we can minimize the chance for late fractures. Pediatrics, we're almost done here. So pediatrics, the major late effects are heart and second malignancy. And this is showing different examples of several radiation modalities. And one of the great examples of where proton radiation has an important place. So protons can minimize the amount of radiation that goes to this patient's heart and stomach, which may portend improved survival, you know, 30, 40 years down the road. So, you know, it's nice that we'll have a proton center in our community soon for these types of patients. Other late effects that you'd be concerned about, the thyroid gland, lung fibrosis, lung scarring. This is not all-inclusive, but you might see peripheral vascular disease, growth abnormalities, so difficulty with development of bone and muscle. So this patient's going to need an endocrinologist, a cardiologist, a pulmonologist. You know, it's really a multidisciplinary effort to take care of pediatric cancer survivors because they're at risk for a lot of late effects. So back to our case. So this patient had surgery and then had postoperative radiation, which started 2 weeks after the incision healed, or sorry, after the surgery was done. And the patient received 10 fractions of radiation delivered to a total dose of 30 gray, which is a common standard treatment for palliation of bone metastases. And the treatment was delivered with an anterior to posterior beam. So there was one beam coming from the front and one beam with a PA approach, so coming from behind. And so thus you can see what normal tissues are in the field. So the heart, there's really not a short-term side effect for the heart as long as you, you know, respect the heart and don't treat the whole heart. The late side effect, again, cardiotoxicity, increase of cardiac events, typically occurs years after radiation. So with a patient with metastatic prostate cancer, you may not be quite as concerned about their heart as a patient, you know, with a better prognosis in the curative setting. The spinal cord, the dose that was selected, there would be a very little risk for myelopathy. But say that you had to come back and retreat this patient and the spinal cord at this level was re-exposed, then you would be concerned that the risk for myelopathy may be higher. The esophagus is in the field for this patient, so they may have some dysphagia, feeling like there's a lump when they swallow. We may give them some oral magic mouthwash or some viscous lidocaine to help with that, or carafate. The spinal bones, so they may be at an increased risk for compression fractures after having radiation in the future. And then, of course, the skin, as a short-term side effect, you may see dermatitis in the front and the back, only within the radiation field. So to conclude, sorry, I went a bit over time, but radiation is an important tool for local regional treatment of cancer with either curative or palliative intent. Complications depend actually on a lot of factors, and you know, it's a bit difficult without knowing what the radiation field looks like. So I encourage anyone who's, you know, curious to give us a call. We're happy to talk about the radiation plans, but it, of course, depends on the dose, the volume, what surrounding normal tissues are exposed, and then, of course, some host factors, lifestyle, genetics, which we're just beginning to unravel and offers potential for improved care in the future. And that's all I have. That's my 1.5-year-old. Gives me inspiration and joy. Thank you. Any questions? Went through a lot. Feel free to call us anytime in the radiation department if there's ever questions we can help. Thank you.